The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, in the last few times I was here, we've been exploring flavors of delusion, doing kind of a deeper dive into beginning to recognize delusion at work in our minds. And the last time we talked in a little more depth around views and how views are a way, the kind of views that we hold can be filters on our experience that influence how we take experience in. And that's a big area where delusion can come in. And so I didn't want to repeat everything that I talked about with views, but I wanted to recap it because there's the area I'd like to lead towards today is there's this whole area in the Buddhist teaching of the Noble Eightfold Path of right view. And so if views are problematic, what's right view about? You know, how does that work in our practice? And so that's the direction I want to head today, is exploring right view and how it is how it is used, how we use it in our practice. So a little bit about views as a form of suffering to start, just to kind of recap that. You know, the views, we have so many views. We live in the terrain of views, and it's very natural as human beings to live in views. Views are, and it's like, you know, just being a human being, we will have views that have been conditioned for us by our cultures, by our families, by our friends, by the way that we've engaged in the world, by things that we've experienced. Views are created. It can be very quick, actually, the creation of views. I told this story last time, but I'll just mention it again, that there was a study done about this, you know, the creation of views. What surprised me was just how fast it was, the views were created. And just, you know, just reflect too on how much suffering just in our culture right now is coming from views, and how strongly people are holding to views, and just the conflict that comes around people holding strongly to views, believing my view's right, your view's wrong. it creates suffering. And just to kind of a little bit of a humbling piece around the creation of views, there was a research study done around views being created, and they basically gave two groups of people different stories about firefighters. So one group, they gave a story about a firefighter who basically followed the letter of the safety rules, very careful in following the letter of the safety rules, and that story went that that firefighter was very successful in saving a lot of lives and in saving as much of the buildings as was possible. And so that was one story one group of people was given. Another story a group of people were given was a story about a firefighter who took risks, who didn't follow the safety guidelines. And that firefighter was very successful, saved a lot of lives, you know, because of the taking of risks. So two groups were given these two different stories. And then immediately after having been given those stories, they were told these stories were made up. No truth to these at all. It's completely fabricated. And then sometime later, they checked in with this group about their views about firefighters and following safety laws and rules. And the views about that were very directly correlated to which of the two stories they'd read. So they had one exposure to the information. They were told it was false, and views were still formed. This is kind of humbling to see. You know, the first thing in sticks. and so this is information for us also that I think we need to take care with our views. It's to take care with kind of counteracting, especially if we're told, oh, here's something that is actually demonstrably false. If we've heard the opposite first, we may have to actually consciously work to overcome a tendency to believe the first thing that we're told. So this is a kind of a humbling thing about the way our minds work, that we tend to create views very quickly. We create views, we have views that are created in our lives about who we are, what we're capable of doing, views about who other people are, what they're capable of doing, and all of these kind of limit our perceptions. This is another way that views function, that when we have it might be as simple as an agenda or an idea about the way the world works, what tends to happen, and this is in current psychological research called confirmation bias, that we tend to look for information that confirms what we already believe. And we actively dismiss information that doesn't confirm what we already believe. In fact, if we do get information, if we hear information that doesn't confirm what we already believe, it may tend to reinforce our own belief. So this is another way that our minds work. We tend to filter information based on what we already believe. Another useful thing to recognize about how our minds work. One study indicated that it can be a couple pieces can be helpful. One around instead of looking for things that confirm our beliefs, actually look for things that disconfirm our beliefs. You know, just be on the lookout for things that show us that, well, maybe there's some piece of that belief that's not so accurate. That we don't tend to do that. It's like the belief creates a filter so that we don't tend to take in information that disconfirms our beliefs. One good example of this is our sense of self. Actually, our sense of self, feeling like I'm an abiding entity, an independent entity, this is a belief that humans tend to share. And it's a very deeply held belief, so not one that we tend to look at, but there's actually evidence all over the place about how that it's not actually the case, that there is an independent abiding entity that's kind of here, permanent abiding entity. And it's just that we kind of dismiss or we don't recognize experience that happens to us all the time as being something that disconfirms that belief. So, simple example. You know, we might think we are sitting down to meditate and, you know, it's like, I'm doing this. I'm going to sit down and I'm going to pay attention to my breath. And so we start there, and then minutes later, the mind wanders. Did you do that? Did you decide to have your mind wander? It was a process. It was a kind of maybe a habit or condition that took place. It wasn't. This is one of the pieces that the teachings of the Buddha point to around the sense of self. That there's a kind of view that, you know, the sense of self should be in control. And this is one of those ways in which it kind of pops that bubble. It's like, you know, here I am, I'm meditating, I'm the one sitting here trying to be present, and the mind wanders. I didn't choose to do that. And then even more amazing is the mind returning from wandering. It's like, who did that? It's like, so there's evidence for undermining some of our deeply held beliefs, if we can just be curious about it. But it tends to be not what we look for. There's dangers in views that the Buddha points to, that the teachings point to. One of the key dangers that the Buddha points to around views is that it tends to create rigidity of mind and leads to dispute, leads to war. Ultimately, that's the roots of war lie in holding tightly to views. This is true, you're wrong. I'm right, you're wrong. And so that kind of conflict in our communities, conflict in our world, arises from this holding to views. Now, this is what we could call clinging to views, with that notion of I'm right, you're wrong. Views, I think, are part and parcel of being human, that we'll have views. And so it's more about recognizing that we are holding views, and not trying to banish views altogether, but simply recognize this is a view. Even recognizing that, recognizing this that I'm holding, or this that I'm thinking about, is a view, as opposed to being truth, that creates a different relationship to ourselves, to others who may hold different views. And so it creates more condition for conversation to happen. Another piece that, just to go back to views and conflict, another study, I've been really interested in all the studies being done around views and conflict these days. I think I mentioned this one last time too, that if you have two people who hold very strongly opposing views, that if in conversation each of those people tries to state their own position, so this is why I believe what I believe, here's my rationale, here's my understanding. So if each person presents their side of the situation, their side of the view, their side of the belief, people tend to get more entrenched in their own views, further separated. If instead the conversation happens where one person says, tell me about your views, if you ask questions, it's like, so what about that part? How does that work? You know, so curiosity rather than this is my view, but you know, okay, so tell me about that. And okay, I don't understand that part. What is it that concerns you about that part? So that there's more of the conversation and curiosity of each one trying to understand the other side, the views tend to kind of, there's more room for dialogue. The views don't get more entrenched. They begin to move closer together. And so that's another area of understanding that's useful, that, you know, especially these days in political conversations, you know, maybe a possible way to have dialogue is to ask, you know, pull from the other person. So tell me about that, you know, with as much curiosity as possible, and not the entrenched idea of like, I'm suddenly going to make you, you know, I'm going to make you come over to my side, but more from the perspective of curiosity. So this can begin to create less tension and less conflict. Again, understanding that we're holding views, as opposed to any one of us having like the corner on truth, you know. It's like, let's learn what we can from each other. So that's one of the things that's discussed in the teachings about views. I mean, a big one is that basically views blind us to being able to receive information fully or accurately, because we're tending to have this confirmation bias to take things in a certain way. And so we're just confirming what we already think we know without questioning it. So this is a danger of views. So views in general kind of obscure what's actually happening when they aren't seen. If we can recognize a view is a view, there's a possibility, there's more room for seeing things as they are, because we recognize, oh, this is just a belief. And this single practice, actually, I will propose to you, and you can check out in your own experience, if you are experiencing some kind of suffering, and this is not the only time views happen. I mean, you might be holding a view and not be suffering, but if you are suffering in some fashion, if there's some feeling of frustration or anxiety or anger or confusion, if there's a feeling of things aren't right, that, you know, that something's wrong here, there is a view that's operating. There's some kind of a view, a belief that is informing that. And so that's something that we can explore when we are struggling. There's often, when we're struggling, a hidden view. And it can be useful to drop that in. You know, so, okay, I'm frustrated right now. What's being believed? What am I being, what's being believed right now? And it can go fairly deep to some fairly core things that feel threatened, like I'm frustrated or I'm angry because I don't feel safe right now. I believe that I'm not safe. There may be, so there's a belief there perhaps that isn't seen, and there can be some truth to those beliefs. Now, so this is again, it's not saying that we have to not believe our beliefs, but recognize that a belief is motivating our actions. Sometimes when beliefs are revealed, we recognize that there's no legitimacy to those beliefs at all, and it's kind of like just being exposed, they kind of wither. Other times we see, no, actually, I'm not safe right now. You know, so this is a dangerous situation. And so that is motivating fear and anger perhaps. But the kind of the exploration around the beliefs that are true isn't to try to convince myself like, oh no, I am actually safe here, it's okay. But instead of being reactive around that situation, to bring wisdom in, to bring compassion in, and maybe the most compassionate thing to do in that moment is to get yourself out of the situation. And so it's not about trying to disbelieve whatever we believe, but just, again, recognizing how, you know, if we can recognize this is not safe here, and instead of being reactive to that understanding that this is not safe, have a kind of a calmness and a wisdom to get myself out of the situation, there's more skill in that. There's more ability to take care of ourselves. So the exploration around views is rich. There's a lot of terrain to explore, and in particular when there's suffering, you know, just checking in. What is being believed right now? And for myself, some of my bigger aspects of suffering, particularly around, I had a very strong pattern of self-hatred that was pretty much just belief. You know, it was just motivated by the belief that somehow I was a failure or wrong or not able to do things well or something. And it was belief that was underlying and just creating this whole field of angst and anxiety and self-doubt and self-recrimination and self-judgment. And at some point, I began to really recognize those beliefs as just beliefs, as just thoughts, and actually not having much bearing in reality. But they were very strongly conditioned, so it took quite a long time for those beliefs to begin to wither. A lot of seeing the beliefs at work and recognizing it's just not true that I'm not worthy or not good or somehow a failure or whatever. It's like, you know, by whose standard is this true? So much suffering can come from views. In the last talk I gave, I talked about some of the ways views form, and if you're interested in that, I'll just point you back to the talk. It's been recorded. So I'd like to now explore, having talked about the way views create a filter, create a kind of a way in which we take certain things in and not other things in, So what is wise view about? Wise view is the first factor of the Eightfold Path. And we're encouraged to reflect on wise view. So a couple ways to describe what wise view is, kind of from the texts, from the suttas. The most common is a recognition or an understanding of the Four Noble Truths, that there is suffering in our lives. The understanding that so suffering not being simply unpleasant experience, pleasant, unpleasant experience will come and go, but there's a kind of suffering around trying to control having pleasant, getting rid of unpleasant, a kind of a craving to control our experience. This craving is the source of the Buddha claims and points to the source of all of our suffering. That takes some understanding because initially we do believe that simply unpleasant experience is inherently suffering. But we begin to understand and recognize that, you know, so as Gill sometimes says, or maybe somebody said this and Gill picked it up, you know, unpleasant experience in life will happen. There's going to be pleasant experience, there's going to be unpleasant experience. So painful experience or unpleasant experience is a given in life. Suffering around that unpleasant experience, we could call reactivity, a feeling it's not okay, it's not right, it has to be fixed, it has to be changed, that it's somehow... And this takes a little bit of, again, some understanding because it's so easy to misunderstand or misinterpret what's being said here. Unpleasant experience is here already. Denying that unpleasant experience is here or somehow feeling like it's wrong or bad or reacting to the fact that it's here, that is what suffering is. That is suffering. Trying to hold on to something pleasant that's here, trying to keep it, that is suffering. Now, this is not to say that, for instance, if you're witnessing some kind of injustice, that means you simply sit there and watch and say, oh, unpleasant, injustice, unpleasant. There may well be a motivation to act about that, but that action doesn't have to come from reactivity, of feeling somehow like anger or aversion about that, but more there can be a connection to compassion, to wisdom in taking an action. This is my understanding of how the Buddha would act when he saw injustice, that it wouldn't come from anger and hatred, but it would come from compassion to wish to alleviate that suffering. It's a very different response to the world. And so, as Gill sometimes says, pain is inevitable, suffering is optional. Because suffering relates to how we are with pain, not the pain itself. And so this is a statement of the first and second noble truths, that there is suffering, and that suffering is caused by this wanting things to be other than they are. And then the Buddha points to the possibility of letting go of that craving, letting go of that wish for this moment that's already here to be different, because that's essentially the problem. That's essentially where the suffering happens, is that something that's already happening, we don't want it to be here. That's like, it's already here. Resistance is futile. It's already happening. So it's really about this very moment that it's possible to release the craving of wanting things to be other than they are for what's already here. And that is freedom. That is freedom. And then that there is a possible way towards freedom, a cultivation of heart and mind to head in that direction. And so this understanding initially, wise view is about taking in this information. And, you know, at first it might simply be, well, I don't know about this, you know. I think there actually is some objective suffering in the world. I don't know that I think it's all created or somehow always a relationship of my mind. But if we're willing to take it in and massage it, you know, explore it, it's like using a view to begin to test. It's like holding a hypothesis in a way. We're holding a hypothesis and testing our experience in the light of that hypothesis. So this is one way that wise view functions. It's pointing out something that we probably wouldn't come to on our own. The whole way that most of humanity enculturates itself is to believe that getting what I want is what's going to make me happy. That this kind of this kind of push-pull around wanting things to be pleasant, wanting to get rid of things that are unpleasant, this is a view that we deeply hold as human beings. It's not even something we have to learn so much from being told it. It's kind of what we learn from our experience, that I'm hungry, I get some food, and that feels good, you know. I also, you know, I'm hungry, I get some food that I like, that feels really good. There's a moment of that anticipation, that feels really good. And so we learn through living our lives that when we get what we want, there's these moments of happiness, moments of ease, of peace, and maybe not real ease and peace, but just a kind of a little bit of a release from a sense of things not being right in our world, in our life. And that moment, we get some of those moments, and we learn that, okay, I am happy when I get something that I want. And there's like not much other demonstrations of happiness in our lives, and so that's what we think happiness, how happiness comes. It's very natural as human beings that this is a view that's very deeply held, that getting what I want, getting rid of what I don't want, will make me happy. And there is a form of happiness that comes with that. But the Buddha understood and began to investigate for himself this kind of happiness and realized this kind of happiness doesn't last very long. I'm looking for something that's more reliable than this kind of fleeting happiness that comes, you know, I get some food and it feels good for a little while, but then, you know, something else happens and I want something else. And so we get on this cycle, and the Buddha realized this cycle is not satisfying. Is there another way? Is there another kind of happiness? And so that was his quest, to see if there's a deeper kind of happiness, a more reliable kind of happiness. And what he teaches about the Four Noble Truths points to a more reliable kind of happiness that comes not from trying to control, but more from aligning ourselves with the truth of the way things are, that things are impermanent, that they are unreliable, that they are out of control. And yet not simply kind of letting ourselves be rolled over by those truths, but instead acting in the world in engaging with those with wisdom, with compassion for ourselves and for others. In some ways, as we really deeply touch into these truths of impermanent, unreliable, out of control, it's like our heart breaks to see just how much people are running around trying to control, to keep things permanent, to make sure that it's reliable. It's like, oh, it's so much suffering out there trying to control our world. And so we begin to see through our own exploration some of the truth of what the Buddha taught. So initially with wise view, we hold it as a hypothesis. We look at it as a hypothesis and begin to kind of look at our experience. It's kind of like, well, you know, let me see. And recognizing, too, that, you know, holding a view will tend to let us or incline us to see things in line with that view. You know, there's a... That understanding is true of wise view as well. In fact, it does begin to orient us to recognize, yes, things are impermanent, things are unreliable. I don't have as much control as I thought I did. So that's one way of stating wise view, and the wise view at the beginning of the Eightfold Path really is about kind of taking in some of the teachings of what the Buddha had to offer. And for me, you know, there's so many little ways that we could frame some of the wisdom of what the Buddha taught. This understanding around, craving creates reactivity in the mind, which is the vast majority of our suffering. That's one way of stating that truth. Another way that I took in from the very first book I read was something along the lines of suffering is reinforced when you're just involved in it. You know, so if you're angry and you're just, you know, spinning in that anger, it's going to get stronger. And one way to begin to break that cycle is to be mindful. Be aware. Be aware that you're angry while you're angry. That was one bit of information I gleaned from a book that I read at the very beginning of my practice. And, that didn't make much sense to me. Like, why would being aware of my anger actually, wouldn't that just make me more angry? That's kind of what my thoughts said about that. You know, it's like, how would that possibly work? But at the same time, I was willing to hold the hypothesis. It's like, I was in a state, I would say. It was a pretty bad state. And I had tried many things to navigate this anger, and nothing had worked. And so I was kind of like willing to try something unusual. Like, okay, mindfulness of anger. Okay, I have no idea how that'll work, but I'll see. Let's see what happens. And so that was a little bit of wisdom, you know, a little bit of wisdom. See what happens if you just notice this is a human phenomenon. Anger is arising. When I first tried it, it was very confusing because I first of all discovered it's very unpleasant to be angry. I don't think I'd ever really noticed that before. Right there's a little bit of wisdom happening too. It's like, wow, why would I choose this? Why would I choose to do this? It hurts so much. Part of the reason we choose to do it is because we think we're getting something out of it. There's a belief in there. There's a view in there. And my view was the person that I'm angry with is going to be made so miserable by my anger. That view, as I began to look at that and see that was a view that was underlying some of this anger, was quickly revealed to be complete nonsense because I was in the Peace Corps. I was 7,000 miles away on a little island in the middle of the Pacific, and the person I was angry with was in California. So my anger was not touching that person. So pretty quickly, that view popped. And it just kind of kept watching the anger. And what I began to see is that, yes, in fact, being mindful of anger, it's kind of like I began to really understand the cycle of the spiraling nature of anger, deepening itself, and how mindfulness kind of stopped that cycle. And not only that, mindfulness began to kind of intercede in the cycle earlier and earlier in the cycle so that it didn't have as much of a chance to get as deep so that I could extricate myself from it more easily. And then even seeing in a moment, and really this moment, I tell this story a lot because it was such a profound moment in my life. It was about 3 months into my practice, I think. And pretty much my main practice at that point had been watching this anger, just watching it. And so one day I was just doing stuff in my kitchen. I was cutting an apple, and I saw in my mind a thought about the person I was angry with. The thought arose, and in this, the next things that unfold, it takes a couple minutes to describe, but it happened in this place, space of a split second. I saw that the thought of the person arose in my mind, and it was connected to what I was doing. So I was cutting a piece of fruit, and the memory was related in that I remembered being with that person at a fruit stand. So I could see that there was a link, a kind of a conditioned link between what I was doing and the memory. And then I also noticed in that moment that I wasn't angry at that moment. Anger was not yet there, but I felt this like, oh, it was like this urge, this like, oh, yeah, I really want to get angry at that person. Just, you know, so there was this momentum of wanting to get angry. The next moment or the next split second was the mind, not me doing this, but the mind recognizing, having spent a few months watching anger, really seeing, wow, anger hurts. Why do I want to do this? Why go to anger? You know, it's like I again, as I understood that there were some beliefs that underlay that anger of why it thought it was helping me in some way. But in that moment, the mind, in seeing the intention or the impulse towards anger, kind of in a flash remembered, that way lies suffering, and let it go. I didn't have to try to let it go. It let go of itself. Knowing that it was headed towards pain in this being, the mind just simply said, it kind of like the way if you touch something hot on a stove, your body automatically pulls back from it. That's what it was like. It was like the mind was headed towards anger and it just said, I don't think so. Not going to go there. And so that experience, that moment, gave me a kind of a deeper felt understanding of that view of why it's helpful to bring mindfulness to our reactive emotions. You know, it was no longer an idea or hypothesis. It became a reality in the depth of my experience. And this is how wise view works. It's a view, basically it's holding a view that points us in the direction. It's not so much a view about, it's not so much a view about the nature of reality. Like, you know, in the Buddha's day, there were a lot of beliefs about the nature of reality, and a lot of people had arguments about it, like the universe is infinite. No, the universe is finite. No, the universe is infinite in one direction, not another direction. So there's just all of these views about like the nature of ontological reality. You know, what is reality? And the Buddha isn't so interested in ontological reality. He's interested in phenomenological experience. He's interested in what is our experience and how is that experience shaped and what shapings lead towards suffering and what shapings lead towards non-suffering. That's the level of wisdom that he's offering us, a very practical kind of wise view. Engaging in this direction creates pain and stress and strife and suffering in our human experience. Heading in this direction releases that pain and stress and strife. So it's very practical. It's not so much about some ultimate nature of reality, more about the nature of our experience. That's the view that he's proposing. And so we engage with that kind of view. We engage with that kind of view. And there's a danger to some extent of having seen, for instance, you know, for myself, wow, that's amazing how seeing that so clearly let it release itself. There can be a danger of picking up and clinging to that view and then becoming a Buddhist proselytizer, you know, bludgeoning people. I've been bludgeoned with people's versions of the truth. You know, so there's a danger to that to some extent. Religions have this kind of quality at times. People, you know, claiming or holding to, you know, this is the truth, and I've experienced for myself. And so if you don't come into line with this, then you're somehow bad or wrong. So, you know, there's that danger that can come even from right view. That even from, you know, a deep experiential connection with right view, there can be a danger of holding to it and creating suffering through that. And so fortunately, the Buddha, you know, in some ways, the way that the teaching is structured, it holds a self-corrective view in itself. So because we're interested in freeing ourselves and not contributing to suffering in the world, and this is a piece of the teaching, to recognize, are our actions, are our speech, are our inclinations of mind creating suffering for ourselves or others or both? And so it's asking us to look at that. If it is, he says, stop. Don't engage in that. Don't go that way. So if we see, holding to right view, that we're creating suffering in the world, right there is a little bit of corrective. It's like, oh, okay. Somehow my holding to this is not, you know, there's a way of engaging with right view that doesn't create suffering in the world. So it kind of begins to hold the seeds of its own release in a way. So we begin by having to pick up right view, hold it as a hypothesis, and maybe even for a while actually have to hold on to it for ourselves. There's an analogy, a simile in the suttas of the path, the Eightfold Path, being like a raft that we build. The analogy goes that we're on a shore that's dangerous, and there's people coming to kill us, and we can make a raft out of what's around us, build this raft, and cross over a flood to get to the far shore where safety can be found. And he uses the analogy of the near shore being like the craving and clinging and all of that those reactive emotions. And building the raft is like the Eightfold Path. It's putting together the understanding of the teachings. And then we use those understandings to cross over this flood of greed, aversion, and delusion. He equates that flood to the flood of greed, aversion, and delusion. And as we're crossing that flood, he says, we have to hold on to the raft. We have to make effort with our hands and our feet to cross over that flood to get to the other side. The teaching does end with the Buddha asking his followers, so, you know, you get to the other side. Is it useful to, having gotten to the other side, to say, wow, that raft's been really useful. I should carry it around on my head and walk around on dry land. No, that's not so useful. He said, no, it's more useful to set the raft adrift, to let it go. And so that's a kind of a pointing to letting go even of the path, even of holding to views. And yet, as I reflect on this teaching, not so useful to try to let go of the raft while you're in the middle of the flood. You know, you actually have to, you're meeting greed, aversion, and delusion. You need to kind of be on that raft, not just jettison the raft in the flood. And so there's a time and a place for kind of holding wise view, orienting our lives around that, but then also recognizing, you know, are we bludgeoning somebody else with this view? So recognizing when suffering is being created by holding to that view. So that's one analogy from the suttas around, you know, the letting go of wise view. There's a way in which, well, actually, I'll say that for a minute. There's another description of wise view that's very directly pointing to how view, the view of the Buddha's path actually leads to the conditions to letting go of views. And it is was a teaching done by a lay person, actually. Ananda Pindika was a lay follower of the Buddha. And he met all of these wandering mendicants from other sects, and they wanted to have a conversation with him, and they wanted to ask about his views. So they said, "Tell me, what are the views that your teacher that Gautama has?" And Ananda Pindika said, "Well, I can't actually tell you the views that somebody else has." And then they said, "Well, how about the monks, the other monks?" "No, I can't tell you that. I could tell you the views I hold. That, you know, that I'll do. But first, why don't you tell me the views that you hold?" And so they all share their views, which are these kind of more ontological type views, views about reality. The cosmos is eternal. Only this is true. Anything else is worthless. The cosmos is not eternal. Only this is true. Anything else is worthless. And so a number of these views were presented, and kind of highlighting that they were holding directly opposing views. And so obvious that half of them at least were wrong. But in any case, then, so they each told their views. And then so Ananda Pindika said, "Well, okay, here's my view. Oh, but first of all, yeah, the Buddha, I mean, Ananda Pindika pointed out to them that when you hold to these views, when someone holds to a view and says, only this is true, anything else is worthless, this creates suffering as you try to hold to that view and as you argue with others around that view. And so in the holding to that view, you are creating suffering." So he first says that to them. And then he says his own view is, "Whatever has been brought into being, so whatever arises in experience, is fabricated, is dependently originated, and is impermanent. Whatever is impermanent is stressful. Trying to hold to what is impermanent is stressful. Whatever is stress is not me, is not mine, is not who I am. This is the sort of view I have." And they tried his argument on him, saying, "Well, you're just holding to that view, so, you know, you're just creating stress for yourself as you're holding to that view." And he says, "Well, when I see stress as arising in any form, I recognize it is inconstant, impermanent, not me, not mine, and in that it releases and there is no longer stress." And so holding the view, essentially, that views create, that holding to views creates suffering. Holding to views creates suffering. It's kind of a way in which the view itself contains the seeds of its own undoing. And this is the sort of view that the Buddha offers in Wise View. We don't have to let go of the raft in the middle of the river. But if we keep watching, you know, carrying the raft around on our heads after we've crossed over, that is stress. There's extra weight there. It's not necessary. And so if we keep looking, the path of our practice begins to reveal itself where we are holding, and that becomes the next thing that we explore. And how's that put together? How's that created? How's that stress created? If that stress is created by holding too tightly to a view of right view, that's what needs to be released. So one other teacher, more scholar, I think, I would say more scholar, points out that, you know, we can think about right view at the beginning of the path as being this hypothesis, this kind of holding to this idea or notion of a different way of exploring the world so that we can take information in a different way, begin to see how our minds have habitually created stress. What might it mean to orient in a new direction? So initially it is picking it up like a hypothesis, and we have to think about it, reflect on it, consciously use it in our minds. So at the beginning of the Eightfold Path, it's more borrowed wisdom, I could say, something like that. It's borrowed wisdom. We take it in and we think about it. Like I thought about that statement, but had no idea how it made sense that watching my anger would be useful, but willing to try, willing to engage. And then as we practice, the understanding that arises is a different kind of understanding than an intellectual understanding. It's a different way of, I mean, that moment of seeing how the mind simply let go of anger, that was a different way of experiencing the world in that moment. Now the mind picked it up later and made a story out of it, but in that moment there was just a different way of relating to the world that the mind understood. This is the release of suffering. This is the non-arising of suffering because the anger did not arise. So that was a different way of seeing. And that's my understanding of the kind of wisdom that comes at the end of the path. It's not the same kind of wisdom as holding a view that's an idea or a belief. It's more of an understanding that comes from meeting experience directly. And this scholar, Fuller, Paul Fuller, I believe is his first name, says this: to abandon wrong views or all views is to abandon attachment to doctrine or dharma, not doctrine itself. The doctrine of anatta is not concerned with whether or not there is a self, but with the fact that craving is the cause of dukkha. Knowing this is right view. Knowledge consists in knowing the cessation of craving, and the knowledge of this is things that they are. When the texts teach that one should strive to attain right view, they are arguing for the attainment of a very specific attitude, a way of apprehending things without any form of attachment. Right view is not simply another view as opposed to wrong view, so not simply something we pick up and believe, nor is it the rejection of all views. The opposite of wrong view is of a different nature, not a mere correction, but a different order of seeing. It's a different way of apprehending the world. That this teaching of right view brings us to be able to see things in a new way, completely new way. So I've used all the time. I'm sorry about that, but we'll continue with delusion in the coming weeks. So thank you for your attention.